Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Wind power off the coast of Massachusetts and calls for a boycott of Arizona. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. After 9 years of divisive debate, the Obama administration has approved America's first offshore wind farm in the waters near Cape Cod. Supporters hail a new green industry. Opponents fear destruction of a national treasure, Nantucket Sound. Also on Which Way LA, LA City Council members are among those calling for a boycott of Arizona, claiming its new immigration law could cause racial profiling. Would Arizona really be hurt? Could L.A. really pull it off? First, here's the news. We're only back with Which Way L.A. on KCRW. In L.A., San Francisco, and Sacramento, politicians are calling for a boycott of public business with Arizona. They claim its new immigration law will lead to racial profiling. What about L.A.'s contract with Arizona for water and electrical power? We'll talk with Councilwoman Janice Hahn and others a few minutes from now. First, this rebroadcast of today's To the Point. The Obama Interior Department has approved Cape Wind, America's first offshore wind energy project, in shallow waters 6 miles from Cape Cod, 10 miles from Martha's Vineyard. Cape Wind now has the federal go-ahead to build 130 wind turbines 440 feet tall. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar made the announcement today in Boston.
Cape Wind will be the United States' first offshore wind farm, supplying clean power to homes and businesses in Massachusetts while creating good jobs here in America. This will be the first of many projects up and down the Atlantic coast, which I expect will come online in the years ahead as we build a new energy future for our country.
Opponents have been fighting Cape Wind for 9 years. One of them is Cliff Carroll. He's the founder of WindStop.org, who represents local residents, the fishing industry, and lots of others as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for taking your time.
What's your response to what has happened? Do you think this is over or not?
It's absolutely not over. In fact, it's far from over. In fact, the real battle will now begin. One of the problems that's been going on with this process is the fact that the federal government has basically ignored all of the objections of the local stakeholders. We still have an FAA determinative hazard issued on the project, which is unresolved. You have the issue with the civil and cultural rights of the Wampanoag Indians, which is now being ignored by the federal government. We've never had the issue of their 40,000-gallon oil transformer platform and damage it would wreak in our economy and marine habitat evaluated. And in addition to that, after 9 years of this project making all types of claims, we have never been told what this electricity is going to cost the ratepayers of the Cape and Islands. It's just an absolute outrage. I think that Secretary Salazar and Governor Patrick and President Obama should be ashamed of themselves for this decision.
What's the transformer platform? I hadn't heard about that before.
No, it's probably one of the best kept secrets. In the middle of this project, just off our pristine beaches, they're going to be putting a 100-foot tall, 200-foot wide, 40,000-gallon electric transformer platform, which contains 40,000 gallons of dielectric transformer oil. We all see what's going on down in Texas. Everybody's worried about an oil spill hitting there. Cape Wind's own oil spill report states that in the event that that transformer ruptures, that oil can hit our shorelines in as little as 4.8 hours. The U.S. Coast Guard has actually already told the president of Massachusetts Fishermen's Partnership that they will no longer be able to fish Horseshoe Shoals, which is some of the richest fishing grounds in the area. There is absolutely no reason this project couldn't have gone to the alternative site on the backside of Nantucket. It's just an absolute outrage. The local Steamship Authority, Highline, the local airports have all filed formal complaints with the FAA, the U.S. Coast Guard, all of which have been ignored. The state's own Massachusetts Historic Officer and the federal government's own historic panel said that this was an area of historic significance and deserved protection. This is just a bad decision being made for the feel-good purpose of providing wind, and the people of Cape Cod are sick over it.
Tell us about the alternative site, quickly as you can.
The alternative site is a site which is located on the backside of Tuckanuck Island, which is just off of Nantucket. It's on the outside of Horseshoe Shoals, where you would eliminate the conflicts with the ferry lines, the conflicts with the airports, the 400,000 flights a year that will travel through this airspace, the dangers of the oil transformer platform releasing inside of the Nantucket Sound, which is essentially a small ocean lake. And in addition to that, it's a steadier wind, which is offshore. But it also, most importantly, takes it outside of the ancient Indian burial grounds and the cultural aspect that will affect forever the religious rites of the Wampanoag Indians in both Mashpee and Aquinna.
Cliff Carroll, again, the founder of WindStop.org, Fighting the Cape Wind Project. This project has divided environmentalists. The Natural Resources Defense Council has been supportive of Cape Wind. Nathaniel Green is the Director of Renewable Energy Policy for the NRDC, and thank you very much for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
How come you're in favor of it, given all that we just heard from Cliff Carroll?
Well, I mean, we've been involved in this process since it started in 2001 and watched the environmental review process. And for a long time, we waited to see the results from that process. And we based our conclusions on our review of the Army Corps' draft environmental impact statement, and then the second draft environmental impact statement from the Mineral Management Service, and then the final environmental impact statement from MMS. And when we looked at that and we talked to our colleagues and experts in the rest of the environmental community, including Mass Audubon, we reached the conclusion that the benefits from this project, which are intrinsic in the technology, lower air pollution, lower water pollution, lower greenhouse gas pollution, outweighed the potential risks of environmental impacts, which are important, and it's critical that we take the mitigation steps that the Department of Interior has required, but we can't afford to keep waiting to get the benefits.
Given what we've seen in the last few days in the Gulf of Mexico, what do you say about this transformer platform that Cliff Carroll talked about earlier?
Well, I think it's important to keep the scale of impact here in mind. In the Gulf of Mexico, the rig down there is leaking thousands of gallons of oil an hour. So 40,000 gallons of oil is not trivial, but it's much, much smaller. And I think the Secretary Salazar put it well, which is, our addiction to fossil fuels has put us in a place where we suffer the impacts of fossil fuels all the time. And if we can't find places and really make commitments to a clean energy future, we will continue to suffer those impacts. So this is a concrete step, shows we can do it. We can do it now. We can move forward.
What about the alternative site outside the Tuckanuck Island?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that both the developer, who's actually doing the engineering and understanding the economics, and the Department of Interior rejected the alternative site. So I hope we can get more projects and more sites developed, but I don't think this is a valid alternative.
What about the concerns for the historic nature of Horseshoe Shoals and its value to the Indian tribes there? The National Park Service apparently split with the Mineral Management Service, both in the Interior Department, and said this ought to be preserved, untouched.
Well, NRDC absolutely respects the traditions and religious practices and history of the First Nations across the country, especially in Cape Cod. Our role is to assess the environmental impacts, and I think the process, the opponents say they ignore issues, but the process has reviewed these issues and taken steps to mitigate them and decided the balance. And from an environmental perspective, we agree that the balance, the benefits, the guaranteed benefits outweigh the risks of the potential impacts.
Cliff Carroll, back to you with the founder of WindStop.org. What chance do you really think you have of stopping this project?
About 100%. What will happen essentially is all of the items that have been ignored and all the science has been put aside. It's just basically been a science versus politics process through the Army Corps, through Minerals Management, and now through the process that Secretary Salazar just allegedly attempted. What will happen here is once this enters into a court of law where the true rules of evidence apply, and then they are not allowed to ignore the science, they are not allowed to ignore issues such as radar interference, oil spills, what this is going to do to the seabed here. They're going to be dredging over 130 miles of cable through our clam flats, through our Nantucket Sound itself is one of the richest squid breeding grounds in the entire world. All of these issues have been completely ignored, and they will not be able to continue ignoring them once we are in a court of law where the rules of evidence apply and where you are not allowed to completely sideline the real issues in the interest, again, of building a feel-good project. Cape Wind will not be America's first offshore wind farm. The project down in Delaware will be up and running long before we're into the courts on this.
Again, Nathaniel Green, back to you with the NRDC. You've been in court arguing against the Army Corps of Engineers, against the Mineral Management Service more often than you've been on their side. What do you say to the legal possibilities here?
Well, you know, we'll have to see who files what suits, but, you know, the process, the environmental impact review process and the environmental impact statements is a critical part of our the way we strike balances when we look at development across the country. This project's taken dramatically longer than the typical coal plant has, and the review, in our opinion, has been dramatically more exhaustive. And again, I would just take issue with the idea that they've ignored these you know, these issues that are being raised here. It's not that they've ignored them. They've looked at them and they've decided that those impacts can be mitigated, minimized, or simply don't outweigh the benefits that we're going to get. So, you know, I think it's unfortunate that we'll have to wait while the opponents continue to try to obstruct this project, but that is part of the review process that's critical for you know, trying to minimize environmental impact. So we'll see what the courts decide.
Well, thank you both for being on our program. Nathaniel Green, again, Director of Renewable Energy Policy at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Cliff Carroll, the founder of windstop.org, for and against the project off Cape Cod. Let's talk more in general terms about what this means for the wind energy industry. Tom Vinson is Director of Federal Regulatory Affairs for the American Wind Energy Association. And Tom Vinson, thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Rather than continuing to debate the situation on Cape Cod, let me ask you a couple of questions. First of all, Cliff Carroll just mentioned a project in Delaware. If, in fact, the Cape Cod project is held back, is there any chance that Delaware could get online first?
You know, your guess is as good as mine about which project is going to be first. I mean, besides Delaware, there's three projects in New Jersey. You know, there's two projects in Rhode Island. There's one off the coast of Texas. There's some Great Lakes projects under consideration by a couple of states. So, you know, which one of those is going to get to the finish line first is anybody's guess.
How important, though, is this decision today in terms of wind energy and the effort to get it underway?
It's very significant in terms of the offshore industry because it signals that the federal government is serious about growing this industry here at home. You know, Europe is far, far ahead of us in terms of offshore development. They have several thousand megawatts in the water already with several thousand more under development. China's first offshore wind project is going to go into operation later this year. So, you know, we're coming up behind other countries who are already taking the lead on this. And the other issue related to not just the clean energy that these other countries are getting, but they're getting the economic development associated with that clean energy. We've seen announcements from major turbine manufacturers that they're going to site new facilities in the UK in order specifically to serve that offshore wind market. And we need to bring some of that manufacturing here as well. But in order to do that, we have to have a signal from the federal government that they're serious about deploying offshore wind here, and today's announcement is the first of those important signals.
Just quickly, given that Scott Brown, one of the senators from Massachusetts, is Republican, of course, who replaced Ted Kennedy, is against this project, is there any threat at all from your standpoint that there might be some change in federal law that would impact this? Or do you think that the wind industry and potential investors will regard this as a green light?
Well, as you heard from your earlier discussion, I mean, there's potential lawsuits and whatnot, too. But I think, you know, the decision today is a significant one, and I think the investment community will look at it as such. You know, I don't want to speculate on what may or may not happen legislatively going forward. But the interior ruling is sort of the final federal say on this, and we'll see what happens going forward. But, the signal to the investment community is clearly that the federal government, the Obama administration, are behind and supportive of deploying clean offshore energy.
Tim Vincent again, Tom Vincent, excuse me, a director of federal regulatory affairs for the American Wind Energy Association. Sam Jaffe has been listening patiently to our conversation. He is in Seoul, South Korea at the moment. He very kindly agreed to participate today. He's a renewable energy analyst for the IDC Energy Insights, which is a market research and consulting firm. And Sam Jaffe, thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Let's talk a bit about economics here. What about the cost of offshore wind energy as opposed to onshore wind energy?
The rule of thumb is that offshore wind energy is approximately twice as expensive as onshore wind in terms of putting the towers up and getting the project going. And that's a factor of, number one, it is more difficult to work in that environment. You have to, you're far from land. You're sinking these towers into the under the seabed, and that's simply more expensive and more challenging than doing it on terrestrial ground. And secondly, there's the factor of the conditions that represent a threat to the equipment out there. So the operations and maintenance of that equipment, because of the salty air, because of the frequent winds, because of the just severe conditions that you experience out in the sea, make operations and maintenance more expensive. However, there's another factor, which is simply we don't have good experience building offshore, especially here in North America, because we haven't done it yet. And any time you do something new, it's going to be more expensive as you learn your way around it. And as Tom mentioned, Europe has a pretty good head start. China is aggressively pursuing offshore wind also. They're learning, they're gaining that expertise in putting these sticks in the ground, or in the water, so to speak. And therefore, they're quickly going down that price curve. So I would expect, as we build more projects, that 2-to-1 price differential will decrease, but it will always be a little bit more expensive to put wind offshore.
Back to Tom Vincent with the American Wind Energy Association. What are some of the advantages of offshore wind as opposed to onshore wind?
In general, the winds offshore are steadier, so you'll get higher capacity factor, meaning the projects will generate more consistently. Obviously, the turbines are going to be closer to load, just being off the coast, so you've got less of a need for long-distance transmission. So in terms of the cost differential that you were just talking about, Cape Wind itself doesn't have a PPA, a power purchase agreement, yet, so we don't know what the cost for sure is going to be. But a couple of the other projects that do have PPAs have varied widely. The Delaware project that was mentioned was around 10 cents a kilowatt hour, which is certainly not 2-to-1 compared to onshore wind. And one of the Rhode Island projects was over 20 cents, so that is more in the 2-to-1 or higher range. So I think at this point we don't know for sure what the cost factor is going to be. But even with respect to Cape Wind, as you may have seen, that some economic analysis that was done recently showed that on the whole, consumers are going to be better off because it's going to be displacing over the long term more volatile fossil fuel prices.
Sam Jaffe, again, you deal with renewable energy of all kinds. What about other alternatives, solar, for example, in terms of cost and availability here in this country, particularly given the higher costs of offshore wind? Are there alternatives that would be a lot cheaper?
Not necessarily, and the reason why is what Tom referred to, which is the closeness to the load. So 80% of the United States population is near a large body of water, whether either the oceans or the Great Lakes. And if you have and you have a lot of wind in those areas also, so you have an ideal situation of siting the generation next to or near the load. Now, if we were to build out more, which we are doing, but if we were to do it even faster, to build out more in the Great Plains, for instance, in the Dakotas, in Texas, and then string transmission lines all the way to the East Coast, the cost of those transmission lines would be nearly prohibitive. So you're balancing this the cost of cheaper onshore wind plus expensive transmission, or more expensive offshore wind plus much cheaper transmission.
Don't you also lose a lot of energy in the transmission lines?
Yes, you will definitely lose electricity in the transmission lines, and that's part of the cost of doing. And the longer you go on those transmission lines, the more energy you will lose. So that's also part of the cost of going down that path.
What about solar? Is that simply out of the question in areas near the coast?
It's not out of the question. It's certainly more advantageous in southern areas where there's more sunlight, more solar insulation. However, New Jersey, for instance, is heavily subsidizing solar photovoltaics today, and that program is ramping up in a big way. But solar is much more expensive today. Hopefully the prices will come down, and we see certainly a path for them to come down in the next 5 to 10 years. But right now, that solar is not competitive with either onshore or offshore wind.
There's a lot of tax subsidy involved here, and Cape Wind certainly will get tax subsidies. Is there any chance, Sam Jaffe, that or will that how will that affect the cost to consumers and taxpayers all around the country?
The tax subsidy is the same offshore and onshore. So in my understanding, Cape Wind is not receiving any favorable federal tax subsidies above what an onshore wind farm would get. And it's in the form of a production tax credit, which is an extra few cents per kilowatt hour that's paid for by the taxpayers, essentially. And it's compared to the subsidies in Europe and some of the subsidies in Asia, it's a relatively small subsidy. It's not an enormous cost to the federal government. And it's understood by the industry and by the government that eventually that subsidy will disappear, will be phased out, and that it won't, at some point it will not be needed anymore. It's essentially meant to spur the growth of the industry.
And Sam Jaffe, once again, a final question to you, as briefly as you can answer, because we're running short of time. Do you think that if Secretary Salazar had not approved Cape Wind today, that would have been a sort of death knell for investors in offshore wind projects in the United States?
It would have been a severe negative, but I don't think it's a death knell. It would have been a death knell. I think that the offshore wind is going to happen. It makes too much sense not to happen, and it's just a matter of perseverance on the part of the developers to get some projects developed. But I think that the fact that it was passed and that it was approved by the Interior Department is certainly a very positive step for the offshore wind industry.
Tom Vinson, a final question to you, again with the American Wind Energy Association. What about consumers here? We don't know what the price, and you indicated this yourself, is going to be of electricity that comes from Cape Wind or any of the other projects for that matter. How do you know that it's going to be affordable and not just so expensive that it has a deleterious effect on the economy?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, the range of pricing we've seen for the offshore projects in the U.S. so far has varied pretty widely, but some of them have been not that much above the onshore wind. And I think, as was mentioned earlier, you know, the pricing in Europe is subsidized pretty heavily, but that hasn't been a major impact to consumers over there. And, you know, it's also compared to what? You know, we don't know where fossil fuel prices are going to go over the long term. We've seen the price of oil and gas vary widely over the last couple of years. And so there's a value to locking in a set price for something over a 20-year period. And so I think, you know, at the end of the day, the consumers are going to be better off from that.
Well, thank you both very much for being with us. Tom Vinson, again, Director of Federal Regulatory Affairs for the American Wind Energy Association, and Sam Jaffe, Renewable Energy Analyst for IDC Energy Insights, again, speaking to us from Seoul, South Korea, in the wee hours there. Thank you both again for being on our program, and thanks for our other guests, to our other guests as well. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. In a moment, should L.A. and the rest of California boycott Arizona on Which Way L.A.? Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. In 1992, Arizona's then-Governor Evan Meekum canceled Martin Luther King Day and made insensitive comments about minorities and women. The result was an organized reduction in tourism from around the country, cancellation of numerous conventions and concerts. An upcoming Super Bowl was moved to another state. Now, Arizona's new immigration law has led to calls for similar retribution. The law requires Arizona police to determine if people are in the U.S. illegally and demand that suspects show their papers. Councilwoman Janice Hahn wants all departments of the city of Los Angeles to, quote, refrain from conducting business with the state of Arizona. Councilwoman Hahn, good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren. It's good to be here.
Why do you want to do this?
Well, I want to do it because I think we need to stand up and be counted as the second largest city in the country, saying we disagree with this law that was passed in Arizona. We feel like it's ultimately a violation of people's civil rights. And we think it sends a bad message. Even though we know a good immigration reform needs to take place, we want to say that we disagree with this. We're a country of immigrants, and we don't like the way this law is going to be implemented. And we think this is the best way to send a message, is to tell Arizona that we don't want to do business with them anymore.
How much business does the city of Los Angeles do with the state of Arizona?
Well, we don't know. That's what we're, this just came up in the last couple of days. I'm asking our city controller, I'm asking all of our city departments, I'm asking our airport, DWP, I'm asking everybody to first look and see what kind of business are we doing with Arizona, and then we're going to ask them to see if we can terminate those contracts.
Well, let me read you a list from the Los Angeles Weekly. They say that L.A. has partial ownership of the Navajo Generating Station in Arizona, which gives the city a substantial amount of its electricity. It also gets some of its energy from the Palo Verde Nuclear Generating Station, relies on transmission lines that cross from Arizona into California. U.S. Airways has a long-term lease for terminal space at LAX. Would you want the city to give up that water and power and the lease for U.S. Airways?
Well, that's exactly what we're seeing. We want to have this come back so we know exactly, how we're doing business, and if in fact this is an area that we can send a really loud and clear message that we're in disagreement. Look,
could the city give up the water and power and do that?
That's, again, we're going to have to look at how much of this we can actually get untangled from. But look, economic sanctions is something that we've done in the city of Los Angeles. We refuse to do business and divested ourselves of investments in South Africa during apartheid. We know that as a country, we've put economic sanctions on other countries when we felt like people's human rights were being violated. So it's not uncommon to take this kind of attack in sending a message.
You are running for lieutenant governor of the state. Your likely Democratic opponent, only one so far, is Gavin Newsom, the mayor of San Francisco. Here's what he initially said about this idea of a boycott.
There's a practical reality that's different than doing sanctions against Burma. It's different than doing sanctions against a country where there may be one or two businesses that indirectly are involved in the life of your city. In this case, this is a state, it's just a stone's throw away, and who knows the relationship in terms of business-to-business operations or city-to-government operations.
Janice Hahn, the suggestion might be there that you're jumping the gun.
Well, you know what? I think the time for having a task force on this is over. you know, when they passed the law, they pretty much sent a message to everyone that unless you had papers on your body, you could face being put to jail or have a fine. And we know that it's probably not the Canadian immigrants they're going to be stopping on the street. And we think it has, this is about racial profiling. And we're targeting Arizona. We're targeting our specific, you know, business interests in Arizona and see whether or not we can, in fact, untangle and send a clear message that we disagree with this. We're a country of immigrants. Los Angeles is a country of, is a city of immigrants. And frankly, in terms of public safety, we know that it's a bad idea for law enforcement to be asking immigration status every time they have contact with someone who looks like they might be an immigrant. That'll hurt public safety on a number of levels.
Janice Hahn, again, city councilwoman running for lieutenant governor of California. David Campos is a member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. He was an undocumented teenager when his family first moved to the U.S. from Guatemala. Supervisor, good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me. It was good to hear the comments from the councilwoman. I think she's absolutely right. And in fact, you know, here in San Francisco, we were the first to call for a boycott because we believe that it's really important to send a clear message to the state of Arizona that in the 21st century in civilized society, we cannot condone a law that essentially opens the door to statewide racial profiling, which necessarily would happen if this law is to be implemented as written.
What about what your mayor has said? Janice Hahn suggested that since he said that, he has now established a task force to look this over. But what's happening in San Francisco? What about the mayor's comments? Isn't this something that ought to be done very carefully, given the nature of the business-to-business relationship between your city, our city, and Arizona?
Well, I think the mayor of San Francisco raises a good point. I would respectfully disagree, though, in terms of how far we need to go. You know, we introduced a resolution yesterday that will be voted upon in a few days that goes beyond simply stopping travel to the state of Arizona, because if there is a rationale for stopping travel, then what's the justification for not going beyond that? I think that there is a model in place that was followed back in the early 90s when Arizona failed to recognize the MLK holiday. That is a model that worked. And that model essentially said, had jurisdictions like San Francisco and others in the country saying, not only are we not going to travel to the state of Arizona, but we're not going to do business with Arizona-based companies. I think that something as egregious as this law requires a tough response on the part of all of us in the rest of the country, especially in California. We have a large Latino population, a large immigrant population. The people that we're talking about are people in Arizona, Latinos or people who look like Latino, who are essentially going to have an extra burden where they're going to have to prove their immigration status. This law allows the police unfettered discretion. I think we have an obligation to be on record that this is not acceptable.
David Campos, member of the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco. Janice Hahn, back to you. Don't you, though, need in Los Angeles, and haven't you really called for something comparable to what the mayor calls a task force when you say this really needs to be looked over, particularly if it involves water and power?
Well, I'm not really creating a task force. One of the things we do on the city council, you know, we don't have the executive power to just order something to be done. What we do on the city council is we ask for certainly the first report back. Tell us what businesses, you know, we're doing business with. What contracts do we have? And then we're asking our city attorney to see whether or not these are things we absolutely can terminate. So this is just the process we do on the city council. But I'm not looking for a task force to look into this or discuss it or debate it. I think we need to all act quickly. In fact, I'm asking the 250 largest cities in our country to join us and also individually send that message to Arizona. We need to put pressure on the state of Arizona and to say we are not happy with this. I'm going to be asking the LA Dodgers to consider moving their train facility from Arizona. I mean, I think we need to get serious about this. This is a slippery slope that I don't think we can stand by and see happen.
Supervisor Campos, back to you in San Francisco. Francisco. Once again, you yourself were undocumented when you came here from Guatemala. Do you think that this will be a powerful issue during this election campaign, particularly for Latino voters in California?
I think it's definitely a powerful issue, not only in California, but across the country. You know, my experience, I was brought by my parents here as a kid. And like many kids, you know, I had no choice in coming here. The only choice I had was in studying and working hard. And many of us came here without a choice, who are playing by the rules, trying to make a contribution. And what this law is, that it puts all of us at risk, because irrespective of what your immigration status is, whether you're a citizen or a legal resident, you are suspect in Arizona. And what I see in my community, in the district that I represent that has a large Latino population, is that people in the Latino community are very upset. They're really angry that this is happening. They feel that it's a slap in the face. There is the story of that young man in Arizona who, you know, right before he went to Afghanistan to fly for his country, he felt the need to go and protest, because here he is risking his life for his country, and yet he knows that while he's fighting over there, his family in Arizona is going to be discriminated against. I think that's going to motivate Latino voters to come out and vote, and that candidates statewide are going to have to make a clear statement about where they are on this issue.
David Campos, a member of the Board of Supervisors, City and County of Los Angeles. Thanks to you, of San Francisco, but excuse me. And Janice Hahn, City Councilwoman here in Los Angeles. Thanks to you as well for being with us today.
Thank you, Warren.
Jim Nensel is a senior writer for the Tucson Weekly. He also does the paper's blog, The Range, and he teaches journalism at the University of Arizona, appears regularly on the local PBS station there to discuss Arizona politics. And Jim Nensel, good to have you back on our program.
Well, thank you, Warren. It's a pleasure to be back.
Given what happened back in 1992, are people in Arizona now worried that this new law might lead to a boycott?
Well, yeah, I think clearly it's ignited a fervor across the country, and that's certainly going to be part of the problem that Arizona faces as a result of this, is concerns about this kind of boycott and conventions not coming to Arizona, and obviously a lot of anger around the country. And our economy is pretty weak at this point. You know, we were largely based on home building, and we've been one of the hardest hit states since the collapse of the home building industry here in Arizona. And tourism is another big aspect of our economy. And to be facing that kind of response is certainly not going to be good for the state's economy here.
As tourism is a seasonal business, what's happening now with regard to the season? Is the tourism season just winding down because it's getting warmer, or are still a lot of people there?
Well, you know, obviously summertime is the roughest time for people to visit Arizona, for good reason. Those triple digits aren't very attractive to many people. In fact, we slow down considerably as a lot of our snowbirds will leave. And the tourism business has been slow. Hotels have been really hurting here in Arizona as a result of just people feeling the hurt all around the country and not having the same kind of travel plans that they had even just a few years ago.
You're in Tucson. It's my understanding that the sheriff of Pima County has said he's not going to enforce this law.
Yeah, he says he's not going to have his deputies automatically checking people for citizenship. Our sheriff, Clarence Dubnik, has been in law enforcement for more than 50 years. And he's a very level-headed guy, and, you know, even at this point, you know, his deputies do have the discretion if they feel as though they've come across somebody who's in the country illegally, you know, out in the desert somewhere in a pack, to call the Border Patrol, and the Border Patrol can come and apprehend them. But, you know, Sheriff Dubnik doesn't feel as though we have the space in our jails to be apprehending people who are in the country illegally. He doesn't feel it's the responsibility of local law enforcement. And one of the things you have to keep in mind is that local law enforcement needs to be able to work with all sorts of elements of the community. And when you have a situation where folks who may be in the shadows are concerned about coming forward and dealing with law enforcement, if they're the victims of crime, if they're witnesses to crime, that's a big problem for the local law enforcement, which is one of the reasons they basically leave it up to the federal government to pursue. But you also have to keep in mind that in southern Arizona, there is a tremendous amount of frustration regarding illegal immigration, because the federal government has done a very good job of sealing up the border in California and in Texas, but they've left a very wide border open here in southern Arizona, and that's where most of the traffic of illegal immigrants has moved to over the last decade. And that's had a number of impacts. Number one, it's put people in very hazardous parts of the country when they're trying to cross, and we've had a lot of people dying in the desert, probably somewhere around 2,000 people over the last 10 years have simply died trying to cross into Arizona. And number two, it's put a lot of pressure on the folks who live along the border, and they've seen larger and larger groups crossing their property. These groups have become more and more dangerous. The coyotes who are smuggling people into the country have become more and more ruthless people. There's been a lot more armed people crossing the border. And it's not just coyotes bringing people across, of course. They're bringing drugs across. There's a lot of smuggling that takes place. And so the folks down there have really felt a lot of pressure, and of course that culminated in the death of a rancher just a few weeks ago. Robert Krentz was actually killed by what appears to have been somebody in the country illegally, and that has really ignited a firestorm in here in Arizona.
Jim Nintzel, senior writer for the Tucson Weekly and also the paper's blog, The Range. Ira Melman is media director of the Federation for Immigration for American Immigration Reform. He is the West Coast leader of that organization and lives here in Southern California. Ira Melman, good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
What do you say to this? Do you support the law in Arizona? How do you feel about the boycott?
It is a sensible response to a problem that has been growing in Arizona for a long time and has been ignored by the federal government. Let's face it, if the federal government was doing its job, Arizona would not have needed to pass this law. But, you know, I think what you heard, especially from Mr. Campos and Ms. Hahn, is a lot of hysteria and misrepresentation. You know, on the one hand, they believe that their cities have the right to flout federal immigration laws, to declare themselves sanctuary cities. We've seen the results of that. We've seen people literally murdered by illegal aliens who had been in custody but had been turned loose because they have affirmative policies of not checking anybody's immigration status, and they want to tell Arizona what to do. Even worse than that is the misrepresentation of what SB 1070 does. It doesn't require racial profiling. All it says is that when a police officer, in the normal course of carrying out his duties, comes across somebody where there is reasonable suspicion, and that's very important, there has to be reasonable suspicion that this individual is in the country illegally, that he is obligated to check further. And an example of that would be a cop pulling somebody over for a traffic infraction. The driver doesn't have a license. The car is registered to somebody else. There's no insurance. The driver doesn't speak a word of English. That would constitute reasonable suspicion to say, hey, maybe this person is in the country illegally and I ought to check further. It's the same procedure that a cop would follow with any of us. When I get pulled over by a cop, I'm asked to show my driver's license and other pieces of identification. Those are the same procedures that a cop would follow no matter who he was pulling over.
Ira Melman, again, media director of the Federation for American Immigration Reform. Tom Sainz is president and general counsel of MALDEF. That's the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund. He's here in Los Angeles. And Tom Sainz, good to have you with us.
Good day, Warren. How are you?
Good. What do you say, first of all, to the kind of concern in Arizona that has led to the passage of this law? Second, to the way it's being interpreted by Ira Melman, somewhat differently from what we've heard so far.
Well, first, I think there's a widespread acknowledgement that the federal government does need to act on immigration reform. Now, there are many of us who believe the major element of immigration reform should be to provide protections and recognition to those millions of people who have been here without legal status and protections, making contributions to our economy and to our society, with the subsidiary benefit of providing status to folks, meaning that we can more easily identify those small numbers of folks among those who are not peaceful, who are engaged in criminal enterprises, and can appropriately act against those limited number of people. Now, with respect to the new interpretation of SB 1070, it's interesting. It's a nice way of trying to make a law that is really quite sweeping in scope sound much more reasonable and humane, but it's not accurate. You did hear that what it requires is for every lawful contact, a police officer has to arrive at a conclusion, reasonable suspicion or not, about someone's status. So it's nice to give an example of someone who's pulled over for a violation on the road. But in fact, every lawful contact includes people who are victims or witnesses of crimes. So when Janice Hahn appropriately pointed out that means that some of those who otherwise might contact law enforcement will avoid doing that. That is exactly one of the major effects of this law if it's ever implemented.
You mean then that anybody who contacts the police for any reason, even if they do it voluntarily, have to be asked about their papers?
They don't have to be asked about their papers, but the police officer is supposed to arrive at a reasonable suspicion or not. And if they arrive at a reasonable suspicion, whether that person's a victim, a witness, or a potential perpetrator of a crime, they still have to, if they reasonably suspect them of being undocumented, ask for proof and then detain them or arrest them if they can't provide it.
Jim Nentzel, back to you with the Tucson Weekly. What are law enforcement officers in Arizona saying about how they intend to act given when this law goes into effect, which I believe is next week?
Well, actually, it's 90 days from the end
of
the session,
okay.
So it won't go into effect for another 3 months. Provided they wrap up the session this week as they're planning. But I think there's a whole mix of reaction, and I think police officers really are not sure exactly how this has to be enforced because on top of what we just heard about the legal requirements and under what circumstances they have to ask for papers, the provision in the law also allows private citizens to sue police officers if they feel they're not being aggressive enough to investigate whether or not someone is in the country illegally.
Let me go to Ira Melman with the Federation for American Immigration Reform on that point. What do you say to that? Is that a reasonable thing to have in the law?
Absolutely, because you have localities that have instituted sanctuary policies over the years, refuse to actually do what is necessary to protect the citizens, and this gives the citizens a legal right to go after those municipalities or those jurisdictions and say, you have to do this. And let me just also correct what Tom Sines just said. There is an exception in this law that says if the police officer thinks that making these sorts of inquiries is going to interfere with a routine police operation, such as questioning somebody as a witness or helping somebody who is a victim of a crime, that you don't have to inquire about immigration status or form any sort of reasonable suspicion at that point. There are clear exceptions in this law that allow police officers to do their jobs, to protect people who are in danger, to protect people who are coming forth with information, and at the same time, still being able to enforce laws when there is reasonable suspicion that somebody is violating our immigration laws.
Tom Sines, what about that? What about these exceptions?
There are no clear exceptions in this law. Moreover, any clear exceptions would be severely undercut by what you've already heard described, which is a private right of action to sue any official or agency. That includes police officers, not just cities that might or might not have so-called sanctuary policies. There's also an anti-sanctuary policy provision in the law as it stands. The private right of action is actually there to do exactly what has been described, which is to push police officers to be even more aggressive about applying their reasonable suspicions as broadly as possible.
Ira Melman, isn't that right? Isn't that what you were implying?
No, it really is to go after government officials who have said affirmatively that we do not want to cooperate. So the example of the sheriff in Pima County who says, I'm not going to do this, now private citizens in Pima County have the ability to say, yes, you are, and if you don't, we're going to see to it that you do.
Jim Nentzel, the sheriff in Pima County, doesn't sound like somebody wants to be pushed around.
No, we'll see exactly how this whole how the threat of lawsuits play out in the future as this thing unfolds. But I think what we're seeing here is a law that may have unintended consequences that the legislature did not consider when they passed it, and I don't think they certainly expected to see the kind of reaction they're seeing with the threats of boycotts and the concerns really across the entire country. But there is certainly a lot of frustration about illegal immigration in Arizona. Some early polls have shown that this law is very popular. It's evidently given our governor a boost in the polls out there as she seeks re-election. But at the same time, I think the people being polled may not know all the particulars of the law, and they're basically reacting to the fact that there is such frustration because of the amount of illegal immigration that actually passes through Arizona.
When you talk about unintended consequences, is there some possibility, given the reaction around the country, that the legislature might try to refine the measure? Can they do that once they have adjourned the session? You said perhaps next week, and they come back into special session or something like that. Is this likely to affect the elections in Arizona between now and November?
I, I don't know that I really doubt that this legislature would come back to refine the law. I think it could have an effect on the election, but that remains to be seen how it plays out. This is the kind of thing that does galvanize Hispanic voters, might bring them out. We saw in California, you guys, with Prop, I believe it was 187, and how that affected politics in California. This could be, in the long term, a loser for Republicans in Arizona because the Hispanics feel very rejected by the Republican Party. But that's one of those things that remains to be seen.
Ira Mellman, quickly, if you will, we're running short of time, but we heard what Janice Hahn, candidate for lieutenant governor, had to say, and what we heard from David Campos in San Francisco as well. Do you think this might lead to people coming out voting against Republicans who support it?
You know, I don't see this as a partisan issue. As he pointed out, this does have the firm support of the vast majority of people in Arizona. There have been polls done nationally. People around the country believe that this is something that's necessary. And what it ought to do is provide impetus for the federal government to actually go out and start enforcing laws that are already on the books. I know Tom Sines wants to hold this hostage to amnesty for illegal aliens. That doesn't need to happen.
Okay, let me in the 30 seconds remaining, let Tom Sines respond to that. Go ahead. Is that what you want?
No, I'm pointing out the need for comprehensive immigration reform, which highlights the fact that really it's a federal responsibility to regulate and enforce immigration laws. Arizona has no business doing what it's trying to do with this law, and it will be held up in court just like Proposition 187 was.
Thank you all. Tom Sines, again, President, General Counsel of MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund. Ira Mellman with the Federation for American Immigration Reform. And Jim Nensel, Senior Writer for the Tucson Weekly. Thanks to our earlier guests, David Campos in San Francisco, Janice Hahn in Los Angeles. Which Way LA, produced tonight by Katie Cooper, Andrea Brody, and Francis Anderton, our managing producer, Carolyn Ranziner, technical director, Mike Newport. Email us, share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/whichwayla. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.